Well, I am glad that you're here this morning. I have a favor to get things started. I need two volunteers to help me with something. You have to just be willing to allow your vitals to be told to everybody. Do I? And Rich, I don't know if you know this, but Rich Maynard is a nurse. He works for an elementary school, and so he's a professional nurse. And he's going to take two people's vitals this morning. Maybe a strange way to start the sermon, but it does have a reason. But I need two people to let their vitals be taken. Do I have two? Okay, Tim, we got one volunteer. Oh, Ray's up and walking. So Rich, come on up. You guys can sit right over here and do the vitals and testing. He has the cuff and all that stuff. I was going to say, can't be a kid because he brought the adult cuff this morning. Okay, so this may be a strange way to start things this morning, but it is going somewhere. In October and November, we're going to be talking about church health. A few weeks ago, and I'm remiss to have not brought you the results of the vote. A few weeks ago, we took a vote. The vote was simply, do you want to continue in Acts in a different series, but continue walking through the book of Acts? Another one in the vote was, do you care or will you be happy with wherever we go? And then the other one was, no, I want to go on to something different, a different book, different topic, whatnot. So the results of that test, by the way, that vote was, overwhelmingly, you said, let's continue in the book of Acts. A little less than half people said, I don't care what way you go. And then there was one vote that said, I want to go on to something different. So sorry, one vote, but we're going to move on in the book of Acts. Well, over the past 20 to 30 years, we have been in the church growth movement here in the United States. It's an era that started back in the 1980s with people like John Maxwell, George Barna plugged into this as well. There were a couple other people that played big into this, Tom Rainer, Donald McGavran, who was a professor at Fuller Theological Seminary in the 1960s, actually is the father of the church growth movement and started this whole thing moving forward. And it was fueled by new tools and new abilities granted to us by this wonderful thing called the internet and better research and able to do research. So it was fueled by people like George Barna and the Barna Research Group, who was doing all sorts of research on the church. And they began to look at what churches that are growing look like, and the church growth movement was upon us. And here's sort of what they came down to. The focus came down to, you're a healthy church, you're a good church, if you're growing in programs, if you're growing in numbers, if you're growing in staff, and you're growing in expanded finances. So if you're doing those things, then you must be a pretty good church. Well, the question that it brings to mind, though, if church health is just marked by those things, to me, those things sound remotely familiar to the business world. Don't they? If you got a good business, it's growing in numbers, the revenue's going up, you're adding more staff, you're adding more product or more ability in your product line. And somehow we took all these things in the business world, the business culture, and we laid it over the church, said if you're a good church, then these are the things that should be going on. And my question is, does that really make us healthy, or does that just show us that we're a growing church? Do those statistics accurately reveal church health? Now, in our modern American age of productivity, it fits quite well. But is that what we should gauge ourselves against? By the way, this runs really deep. It doesn't run just deep, and I'm realizing this, in the pastoral circles, because, I mean, this stuff's been grabbed a hold of. It's the size of your programs that matter in denominations, in churches. If you start to raise a voice that goes against that, you're considered a heretic. But it's interesting because it also runs deep in the pews as well. There seems to be this idea that a larger church is healthier than a smaller church. That if you're a church of 2,000, you must be healthier than a church of 200. If you're a church of 200, you must be healthier than a church of 20. But is that true? Is that really a good sign of health? You guys done? Still working? Okay, so how'd they do? They doing okay? So was Tim okay, good, bad? What was his vitals?
120 over 80.
120 over 80?
I'm going to borrow. It was 83 for pulse.
Okay, 83 for pulse. How about Ray?
160 over 100.
160 over 100? Okay,
high.
Little high? Okay. Now let me ask you a question here before we let you guys go. How do you know those are the markers, that he's healthy and not so much? Still okay, but I mean, besides, I mean, how does the health community know that?
It's just a standard set. method in science, 120 over 80 is the benchmark.
Okay.
You start with.
So they looked at a bunch of healthy people and decided that's probably what a healthy person looks like.
Yeah, and then everybody's different, but that's the benchmark that you start with.
Okay, so we know that Tim's not doing bad, Ray, and he's okay.
Science has something to do with it.
Still alive. Amen. Okay. Well, thank you, guys. Thank you, okay, for coming up. I thought this was interesting. As I was thinking about health of a church, how do we know? That's a huge question. How do we know the church is healthy? Now, in our modern culture, what we've done is we've looked at a whole bunch of other churches in American culture in the last 20 years, but is that a good sample? Because we got to remember, we looked at this a few weeks ago over the last series when we started the book of Acts. The church was started how long ago?
10 years?
The whole church, the church.
2,000 years.
Are there just a couple churches? Are there thousands of churches? Does the church just exist in America? No, it's all over the world. Does the church just speak English? What? I thought that's what missionaries do, is they go teach other people to speak English. All right? You know, so is it really a benchmark to only look at churches in America, in American culture, speaking English? Is that really the best benchmark to know, is a church healthy? Or should we maybe go back a little further, because there's a lot more churches than just American churches. Should we go back way before American culture? Maybe we should go way back to the beginning. Oh, here's an idea. What if we went back to the reason why the church was started in the first place and how the church got started? Would that be a pretty decent benchmark to know if a church is healthy? Okay. Now, the good news is we can do that, and it's called the book of Acts. We can go back and actually look at this book and see how was the church started, how did it get going. We can actually see some formulas happening here as to what develops and what makes a healthy church. So maybe if we want to understand the vital signs of a healthy church, maybe the best place to go, just by chance, might be here. Am I off? Okay, y'all looking at me like, what? You know, and I tell you what, you know, this whole church growth movement I have been a part of in my whole ministry. It started when I was in college. And I tell you what, there's a lot of guys writing a lot of books that tell you what a healthy church looks like. But I still think this is the best place to go to see what a healthy church looks like. So let's go back to the scriptures. Let's go back in here and dig around a little bit. What does a healthy church look like? Well, the book of Acts is a great source to go to discover what does a healthy church look like. What fascinates me is the book of Acts shows us overwhelmingly the church's health is more about the quality of its programs than the quantity of its programs. In fact, the health of the church, this is worth writing down maybe, the health of a church is much more about the quality of its people than the quantity of its programs. In other words, you can have all sorts of programs going on in the church, man. You can have stuff for the kids and for the babies, and you can have stuff for teenagers and adults and young adults and old adults and middle-aged adults and all that group that doesn't want to call themselves any other group that's an adult in the church. And you can have all sorts of those ministries going on, but that doesn't mean the church is healthy just because it has a bunch of programs. The way we know that a church is healthy is by looking at the heart of the people, the quality of its people. Is what really shows us the health of a church. A church is healthy. A church's health has more to do with the quality of its people than and its spirit than the quantity of its programs. So if we go back to the book of Acts, I'm going to recap here really quick. The book of Acts lays out the church's infancy. So it tells us how this whole thing got started. That's what we looked at in the last series called Unstoppable Force or Unstoppable. We first see that the church had a mission. And the mission of that church was to declare the good news of Jesus Christ. And it's fascinating. Every time a miracle happens in the book of Acts, it directly goes to the point of declaring louder the mission of Jesus Christ. So something great happens in the church. The reason it happened was so that the gospel could be declared louder, more loudly. And that is the message of the church. It has a great mission to go and make disciples of all the world. And it has a great message to share the gospel message. It has at its core love. We see love showing up. We looked at that in that last series. It has unbelievable opportunities. In fact, it looks at obstacles and it moves obstacles into opportunities. So any problems that come up, hey, those aren't problems. Those are opportunities for us to do something different or do something great. It has unbelievable courage. Boy, when you walk through the book of Acts, these guys are getting beat up, thrown in jail, ridiculed, persecuted, all sorts of stuff happening to them, and yet they just have more and more courage. And also, we looked at in the last series, or last sermon in that series, it has unbelievable impact. If a church is healthy, it is going to have impact. In other words, some of that church growth stuff is important, that the church will be growing, that the programs will be growing, that ministries will be growing. If a church is healthy, it will be having an impact on the people inside the church as well as the people outside the church. And this is sort of fascinating. We touched on this in that particular sermon. If the church inside looks exactly like the world outside, is a church healthy? Not at all. If your life inside looks the same as every other person that's not a believer on the outside, are you healthy spiritually? No. There is an impact the gospel makes on us. If you want to explore these topics in more detail, you can go back to the podcasts on our website. You can go back to Facebook Live. Oh, by the way, hi, Facebook Live people. Everybody say hi, Facebook Live people. I also want to tell the Facebook Live people, Ray's watching and he's responding. Just put a little note down there. Hey, I'm watching, because Ray would like to say hi to you, for you that don't say hi. So he'd love to say hi to you this morning. So hi, Facebook viewers. Glad that you're here this morning. So you can go back to Facebook Live and you can watch online as well. Those ideas are just starting points to what a healthy church is all about. So what we're going to do is we're going to move on into the book of Acts, and we're going to be exploring and looking at the vital signs of a healthy church. We're going to pick up where we left off in chapter 4, and we're going to move on into chapters 5 and 6 and into 7 a little bit. And what we're going to see happen in Acts chapter 5, this all starts to take place, and even in 6, the church now begins to become organized. I said it. Organized religion.
Oh, I hate organized religion.
Well, guess what? If the church is not going to die, it's going to have to become organized. And this is exactly what begins to happen in the next couple chapters of this book. The church begins to organize how it works. Everything, every organization, every business, every company, every country, if it's going to survive and continue to go forward, somewhere along the line, it's going to have to move from its infancy into its adolescence, and it's going to have to start to become organized. And the church is no different than that. In Acts chapter 5, we see the organization starting to come about. At the beginning of this thing, at a church plant, when this thing first started, everything is new and exciting, and everything just seemed to work. And maybe, if you can remember back to when you gave your heart to Jesus Christ, maybe you remember those days when everything just worked. God was there. It was exciting. You were learning all sorts of new things. And you know what? Every church goes through that too. Every organization goes through it. At the beginning, everything is awesome and everything is fun and everything is new and fresh and it's exciting. But sooner or later, if you're going to survive, you're going to have to start to get a little organized. In other words, you're going to have to start answering the questions of who's really in charge. You're going to have to delineate lines of authority or delineate lines of leadership within the church. Who's supposed to be doing what? Rules are going to have to begin to be followed. Yeah. How many of you like the Ark out there? You like the Ark out there? Isn't that cool? Man, it is so exciting to have built that thing. But I tell you what, as soon as we built that thing last Sunday, it dawned on me. Well, here's how it all happened. I'll just give you a quick story. You mind if I sidetrack with a fun story? Okay. We're in here, and somebody, one of the dads, I won't say who, but the wife sat up here. We're standing in the back, and Matt looks over at me. He goes, "Is there any adults outside watching the kids?" And I said, "I don't know." So I walk out the door. I come outside, and what do I see? I see the kids with handfuls of seawater. throwing it outside the playground. First thing that I did was what? No! It stays in the playground. So they're chucking it at one another, and I'm thinking, okay, this is sort of fun, ha, 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 ha. And one of the bigger kids, I could see their frustration getting a little higher and a little higher, and he was probably the one that started it, and started getting, and so finally I said, okay, put the blue stuff down, no more throwing blue stuff. I'm like, and then I saw the littlest ones going, no! Don't you love it? You do something cool, and we got to start adding some rules, you know? But that's just the reality of life. And even in the church, when a church begins to move from its infancy into adolescence, it's going to start developing some rules. How do things work around here? What do we believe in? What is true? What is not true? If you were to join a bowling league, the bowling league, as it developed, would start to also develop some rules. And here's one of the rules. If you don't bowl, the bowling league's probably not for you. Because we bowl on a bowling league. Now, if you love baseball, that's great for you. But if you hate bowling and don't want to bowl, don't sign up for the bowling league because we bowl. Right? Guess what? When the church begins to develop, it somewhere along the line starts to put some rules out there, starts to develop some theology. We are a church. We are Christian. Because we're Christian, we believe in Jesus Christ. That's what's the center of this thing. Now, you can be a wonderful person and you can love baseball all you want, but in the church, we bowl. In the church, we do Jesus. Right? And this is exactly what starts to unfold in the book of Acts now when we move into chapter 5. Things start to develop within this new church. It starts to move from infancy into adolescence. Now, I love one of the authors that I read this week. One of the commentators said this, and I just thought it was a beautiful sort of putting this whole big picture together. And what they stated, I'll just read this to you. Luke was the author, the man Luke, the apostle disciple Luke, was the author of both Acts and the Gospel of Luke. The two books actually are one account stretching from the birth of John the Baptist in Luke 1 to the death of Paul in Acts chapter 28. So you have to remember this. Luke wrote this as one big story. Later down the road, the church divided it in two, called one Luke, because it was his book, and one Acts, the start of the church. But it was really one big story in the beginning. The Gospel of Luke is less frequently used as a reference for church growth. In Luke, however, the foundational ideas are laid that support the growth found in Acts. The Gospel of Luke is prescriptive, whereas the book of Acts is descriptive. The Gospel of Luke focuses on why things happened in the church, while the book of Acts focuses on what things happened in the church. The Gospel of Luke turns our attention to principles, while Acts turns our attention to practices. I love that background. We can't separate these two books. It's one continuous story. And I like the way Luke, or the way this author put it about Luke. In the book of Luke, Luke wrote about principles. What are we supposed to be about? What was Jesus about? Who was he? They were principles that we're to live by. But then in the book of Acts, he sort of turned the page a little bit and he said, now this is how these practices work out in everyday life. This is how love works its way out in fixing somebody's car. Thank you, Carl, for sharing that. And that's the difference between Luke and Acts. They're one big story. Well, this sets us up for a perfect marker that we're going to look at this morning, a perfect vital sign that's presented to us in Acts chapter 5. Vital signs of a healthy church. In a healthy church, sin is not ignored. Sin is not ignored. You know, too often in the church world today, sin is ignored. It's looked over, it's excused away, and this leads us to an unhealthy church. Now, there are big sins, big, nasty, hairy, beasty sins, and we're not going to really get into those this morning too much. They're the big things like sexual orientation, all that kind of stuff, you know. We're not even going to go there, because here's the reality. Most churches are not taken out by big sins. Most churches are not taken out by the pastor having an affair with the worship leader. I get to do that. Most churches aren't. There are some, but not a lot. Most churches are taken out by small, little sins. Gossip, dissension, negativity, deceit, lying, gluttony. Most churches are taken out by those small things. They're not taken out by the big things. A little bit of history here. When the church begins to ignore those little things, eventually they become big things. Let me give you a case in point just from our own heritage as a denomination. We're part of the Wesleyan Church. And years ago, there was a sin that was ignored inside the bigger church. We, by the way, came out of what was called the Methodist movement. And I don't know if you've studied much about church history or if you have Methodists in your background, but the Methodists were started by John and Charles Wesley. It was started over in England. They invaded and came over here, and the Methodist movement just took off like wildfire here in the United States, and it changed, it revolutionized the country of England. The Queen of England said that it was greatly due to John and Wesley, the John and Charles Wesley, the brothers, their influence over England that saved England from corruption and just disaster. So the Methodist movement was a huge, huge deal. But then over here in the colonies, the Methodist church was taking off, and it was going wildfire. It was going all over the colonies. It was down south. It was up north. It was a wonderful church for the new prairies and the new lands that were being explored as we moved further and further west. And this church just began to expand all over the place. And then there was a little problem, a little hiccup in our country, and it was called, some of you might remember this in your history books, this little thing called the Civil War. Anybody remember that little thing? Okay, liberals might want to change what it was all about, but, you know, it happened, and we got in this big war. Does anybody remember what the war was about at its heart? Slavery. The slave trade, okay? Now, I don't know if you know this or not, but the church also went through a civil war at the same time. And here was what was happening inside the church. Inside the church, there was this group of people called the abolitionists. Have any of you ever heard that name, or abolitionists? And they were rising up, and they were saying, this idea of slave trade is wrong. It's sin. As Christians, as followers of Jesus Christ, we can't participate in this kind of thing, in this kind of business, in this kind of lifestyle. Now, some people like to think the church has no business telling me what to do in my business. Really? Because here's slave owners who were saying the exact same thing years ago. And here's what happened inside the church. The Methodist church refused to take a stance. They were silent. You know why? Because they had very, very wealthy landowners down south that said, "How dare you take a stance against us? How dare you call what we're doing sin?" And you know what the church did? Well, what happened inside the church is people started to raise up. People like John C. Scott, Orange C. Scott, different guys that began to raise up that were abolitionists and said, this isn't right. And they began to leave the Methodist church by the droves. And churches, the Methodist church went, and all these churches went all over the place. Now, the government came in and did a little something. They called it the Civil War. We had that big war. They solved the slave trade issue and the slavery issue. By the way, that Civil War ended slavery, but it did not end or start equal rights. That's a whole other issue, okay? And the way we treated blacks even after that, it's just been wrong. But anyway, the slave trade was ended, and then all of a sudden, all these churches are like, okay, that issue's over. You know, the church is now, you know, obviously going down that road because it's the way the government said we have to go. And they all came back in. They called what was called, they formed what was called the United Methodist Church. But there were some churches that said, no, the way this was handled was wrong. We cannot look the other way in the church when things are not right, when there's sin in the camp. And they said, we can't go back into that. And they stayed out. Churches like the Pilgrim Holiness, the Wesleyan Methodist Connection of America. Some of you might know this name, the Nazarenes. Anybody know the Nazarenes? Heard of them? Nazarenes, Free Methodists. All these different denominations began to spring up because they said, no, we're not going to go back into that. And they formed new denominations, of which we are one of them, the Wesleyan Church, the Wesleyan Connection of America. In 1968, we merged with the Pilgrim Holiness and became the Wesleyan Church. But that's a little bit of our own heritage. Let's go back to the principle that Luke lays out back in the book of Acts, or back in the book of Luke, and then we're going to come forward and look at this principle being played out in the book of Acts. A healthy church cannot ignore sin within its walls. To some who are confident, and this is a story from Jesus' life, to some who were confident of their own righteousness and looked down on everyone else, Jesus told this parable. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood by himself and prayed, God, I thank you that I am not like other people, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like that tax collector. I fast twice a week and I give a tenth of all I get. But the tax collector stood at a distance, Jesus said. He would not even look up to heaven, but he beat his breast. He said, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. I tell you that this man, rather than the other man, went home justified before God. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. This is a principle that Luke lays out in his book. Okay, he's laying out this principle. So what is happening here? In Jesus' day, the Pharisees and the Sadducees, the teachers of the law, they were highly regarded as righteous people, as pious people. If anyone had their spiritual act together, it was going to be those guys because they had it all together spiritually. They were the ones everybody looked up to. And when Jesus came along, it became more and more evident that these guys weren't nearly as put together as they thought they were. And Jesus began calling them on the rug for it. He began to say, man, you want to look great, but you're not really great. In fact, in another occasion, he was over at another leader's house, a Pharisee's house, and the Pharisee got all upset because Jesus didn't wash his hands before the meal. And Jesus said, what's up with you? You know, you get so bound up with all your rules that you forget people. In fact, there was another guy that he healed on the Sabbath. Jesus healed on the Sabbath. And the Pharisees got all upset about that. And they said, how dare you heal on the Sabbath? You know, there's Monday through Saturday to heal people. Why are you doing that? Sunday through Friday. Did I get it right? To do it Saturday, you know, is a Sabbath. So how dare you do that? And Jesus said, my goodness, come on. If you all had an ox and it fell into the ditch on a Sabbath, you would go get that ox out. What was Jesus doing? Sin, how dare you? You value your ox more than you value a soul. You value a farm animal more than you value a man. He's poor, and obviously you don't like him. I love the passage that happens in Luke 11:45. Jesus was eating at a Pharisee's house. He got offended because he didn't wash his hands. Jesus goes off on the Pharisee. He says, man, you love the places at meals. You love honor. You love to puff yourselves up. You know, when you come in, you look for the best place to sit, and you sit down because you think you'll be honored there. And he just really goes off on this Pharisee. In fact, he goes off on the whole Pharisees and the whole group. And a couple of things Jesus constantly was saying is, you know, you make a person twice the son of hell before after you meet them than before they meet them, because they come to you and they want to learn about Jesus, and what you do is learn about God, and you dump all sorts of rules on them where they don't feel like there's no way I can become godly, so you make them worse than before you found them. And he's going off on this Pharisee, and I love this, and I'm thinking, are you an idiot or what? This teacher of the law is sitting there, hears all this going on, and he then says to Jesus, teacher, when you say all these things, you insult us also.
Duh.
I read that, and I'm like, hey, this was in my Bible reading this week, in my year Bible reading in a year. And I'm like, what an idiot. If he's going off on your buddy Pharisee, why did you open the door, you know? And of course, what's Jesus do? He looks over at him, and he begins to go off on him. He says, you do all your acts of righteousness to be seen by people. You puff yourself up so that people go, ooh, ah, but inside you are dead. In fact, in a couple other passages in Matthew chapter 23, Jesus says, you're full of dead man's bones. Your holiness is as filthy rags. And he's constantly going after the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, and the Sadducees, the spiritual leaders of their day. Now, this is a huge warning. A big principle that Luke constantly is painting in his book after his name, the book of Luke. Now in Acts chapter 4, the church is now exploding. The church has seen all sorts of miracles happen. Peter healed a guy. He got in trouble for it. Him and John got thrown in prison for it. They get released. They get out. They come back in Acts chapter 4 and tell the disciples because they didn't know what was going on. So they told them all the story of what just happened. They prayed for the church, this unbelievable prayer. We talked about that a couple weeks ago. You know, they prayed that God would infill them and infuse them with courage and boldness to speak the name of Jesus Christ. And then at the bottom of the chapter, so the church is starting to expand. At the bottom of the chapter, we're given a glimpse into this one man's life and this one man's actions. Let me read this to you. Bottom of Acts chapter 4. Joseph, a Levite from Cyprus, whom the apostles called Barnabas, which means son of encouragement. By the way, he becomes later Paul's mentor. Okay, so if you keep reading in Acts, you're going to read ahead this week. This Barnabas becomes Paul's mentor. Well, he sold a field he owned, he brought the money, and he put it at the apostles' feet. People were so excited about Jesus and his ministry and this new thing called the church that they were giving up money, they were giving up land that they had to see the gospel go forward. And Barnabas was excited to do that. And so he, along with a lot of other people, were going to big extremes to see the church move forward. It was exciting times. And Barnabas was hailed as a leader of the church. What an awesome guy, what an honorable thing to do, to sacrifice so that the church can move forward. Barnabas had a right heart of generosity. He understood who God was. He understood that God had given him everything. He had a passion for the church. But then along comes a man and his wife that decide to also sell a field, but their motives are totally different. Barnabas was motivated out of love to give to the church. He wanted to see the church expand and explode and continue to grow. He had an understanding and trust of God. He loved the ministry of the church. But Ananias and his wife Sapphira saw honor and accolades. They saw the pats on the back and the attaboys that Barnabas got and received for his generosity. And they, unlike Barnabas, wanted to be seen as spiritual giants, so they too sold a field, but their motives were totally different. Let's read. If you have your Bibles open, Acts chapter 5, we're starting with verse 1. Acts chapter 5, verse 1. Now a man named Ananias, together with his wife Sapphira, also sold a piece of property. And I thought this was interesting. The commentator said that it shouldn't be, the first word in this chapter should not be now, but should be a but. Okay, so right there, but a man. So we just have the story of Barnabas, but a man named Ananias. Okay, just to make the link here. So with his wife's full knowledge, he kept back part of the money for himself, but brought the rest and put it at the apostles' feet. And then Peter said, Ananias, how is it that Satan has so filled your heart that you have lied to the Holy Spirit and have kept for yourself some of the money you received for the land? Didn't it belong to you before it was sold? And after it was sold, wasn't the money at your disposal? What made you think of doing such a thing? You have not lied just to human beings, but to God. That's huge. Do you catch the similarity of what Ananias had done to what the Pharisees were doing? Luke lays out the principle. Here's the Pharisees. I want honor. I want accolades. I'm the pastor. I'm the leader. And yet their hearts were horrid. And here is Ananias doing the exact same thing. They were lying about their own spiritual state. They wanted everyone to believe that they were holy when in fact they were not. Ananias, how is it, Peter said, that Satan has so filled your heart that you've lied to the Holy Spirit? Luke principle, Acts practice. Let's continue to watch how this unfolds. When Ananias heard this, he fell down and died. I got thinking about this week because this is my strange mind. If that happened today, we would have cops here, the sheriffs here, the state police, the FBI, and everybody else. And it would take us months to unravel that thing. Really? God struck him down. We had nothing to do with it. You know, Tim, we just did Tim's vitals. He was a healthy kid. Really? So he fell over dead. Scriptures go on. Then some young men came forward, wrapped up his body, and carried him out and buried him. Talk about quick burial. I mean, you're dead within an hour before your body's cold. They got you in the ground, you know. I really hope he was dead. Okay. Well, about 3 hours later, his wife came in, not knowing what had happened. I'm reading in Acts again. And Peter asked her, "Tell me, is this the price you and Ananias got for the land?" "Yes," she said, "that's the price." And Peter said to her, "How could you conspire to test the Spirit of the Lord? Listen, the feet of the men who buried your husband are at the door, and they will carry you out also." Again, Luke, principle of honesty and integrity, Acts, practice of how it's lived out. At that moment, she fell down at his feet and died. Then the young men came in, and finding her dead, carried her out and buried her beside her husband. And great fear seized the whole church and all who heard about these events. What if that took place right after our tithes and offerings on a Sunday morning? "Is that all you have, Tim?" I'm going to pick on you because you volunteered to do the vitals this morning. You know, it's interesting. Jesus seldom criticized people who were coming into the church, coming into salvation. When you go back and read the gospel accounts, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, he seldom criticized the people, the drunkards, the tax collectors, the harlots, the nasty folks of the day. He seldom criticized them. He always lifted the bar, you know, like the lady caught in adultery, "Go and sin no more." So he didn't give them a free pass on sin. "Go and sin no more." But he seldom ridiculed them. He seldom picked on them and said, "Man, your heart's messed up." He never did that. You know who he did this to? The people who should know better. The Pharisees, the teachers, the Sadducees, the leaders of the church, the people involved in religion, organized religion of the day. Now in Acts, Luke gives us a glimpse into the church, and the exact same thing is taking place. A person in this new church is wanting honor by men over honesty with God, desiring men's praise over honesty before God. And Ananias and Sapphira have wrong motives and a sinful heart. They are people who should have known better. So don't fool yourself for a second and think, well, they just didn't know any better. And yes, they did. They were around long enough. They should have known better. The principle Luke is laying out, and the practice then, is that those who are coming into the church, those who are seeking God, we must be loving and gentle towards, accepting, welcoming, and helping them grow in their faith and move forward with Jesus Christ. But sooner or later, every person moves from being a newbie to a resident. Sooner or later, all of us move from just darkening the doors and, "Whoo, what is this thing called church?" to, "No, this is my place. This is my home. I'm a part of this place." And Jesus would never pick on the newbie, but boy, did he hold the standard high for those who should know better, for those who were part of this thing. And Acts shows us that practice, that God takes lying and deceit within his church very, very seriously. The Jewish religion messed it up. And as God forms the church, he sets the bar really high. He sets the standard really high. If you are going to be a part of the church, if you have aspirations of leadership within the church, if you're going to be involved in the ministry of the church, your heart needs to be right before God. And it better be. There's a couple principles that I want to just jump into, and then we'll jump out, and then we will be done this morning. A couple quick principles. Here's the first principle, and this first principle goes to the church. The next two go to us as individuals. First principle for the church. As a church, as a healthy church, we cannot afford to ignore sin in the church. As a healthy church, we cannot afford to ignore sin in the church. And I hope that's a lesson hopefully learned. Dissension, gossip, negativity, deceit, lying. It can't be tolerated by those within the walls of the church. Now remember, the standard's different from those that are coming into the church than those who are in the church. In my post as a pastor, I end up getting into a lot of conferences and training type events, and all sorts of big churches clamor for more attention, so they want to, you know, come to our church and we'll tell you what we did, and if you do what we did, then you're going to look like us. Yeah, whatever, doesn't work that way. Lots of glitz and glitter at a lot of these different conferences that we can go to, and they have a lot of good stuff. You have to take the good from the bad. You have to take what can work for us and what won't work for us and so on and so forth. I've been to enough of them to know, though, that in most of these conferences, most of these guys, and it's mostly guys, sorry ladies, but guy pastors, most of these guys never talk about what really changed the church. Because that was painful, it was hard, and it's not fun to talk about. So they don't talk about it. They rather would love to show you their worship team and the coolest stuff they got on the stage and their latest kids program material. That's what they'd love to show you. They won't show you the underbelly. I got introduced to this quite a few years ago. I was in a two-year cycle teaching conference thing with our largest church in our denomination, 12 Stone Church in Atlanta, Georgia. Just to give you a little bit of perspective, we're barely big enough to be one of their Sunday school classes. They have 14,000 people in their church. This thing is huge, right? And so I was going down there, you know, meeting with their staff, and there was about 20 of us meeting with the staff, meeting with Pastor Kevin, the pastor of the church there. And it was interesting because finally, after a couple meetings, off came all the facades and the pretenses, and we sat down, we started talking about church. And I will never forget one of the stories he said, and I've since seen him talk about this, so my kudos to him. I really applaud him for this. He went down as a church planter from Michigan, and he planted this church down, and it was actually a church plant out of a church in Michigan. They sent him down there to plant this church in Atlanta, the fastest growing city in the United States, been that way for years. And so he went down there, planted his church, and it popped up. They did all the church plant stuff, just like Mark Leist and his buddies are working to do. It popped up, but it stayed at 98 people forever and ever and ever. He said it was the Heinz 57 church, you know. We couldn't get above 57. We didn't go below 57, but couldn't get above 98, you know. We never could break 100. And we stayed there for years. He said, I got discouraged. I got upset. I was about ready to quit, and I about did several times. But his mentor back in Michigan said, stay in there. So he went back down. He stayed in there. And finally, the church broke some growth barriers, and they got up to 200-300 or so, and then they got really stuck. For like 5 to 10 years, he sold his house. He ended up working a second job. His wife had a full-time job, and they had little kids at the time. I mean, it was not good. There was not money in the church. Things just weren't growing. They were doing, and he said, we were doing everything right. We were doing all the right programming. We were doing all the right things. We were doing the right outreach. And he said, you know, everything was right in the church, but it just would not go. And so he made a trip back to Michigan to look for a job back in Michigan. Actually was selling off all of his stuff back in Atlanta, getting ready to close up where they were living, and getting ready to pack and go home back up to Michigan. And his pastor back up in Michigan said, no, that's not what you're called to. Go back. And so he went back. And he said he was so frustrated with the church. He just was so discouraged with this whole thing. And he said one day he was in his office, and at that time, at the 200 marker, they were able to have a staff member or two. And he said he overheard one of his staff members crabbing about one of the leaders in the church. And he didn't think much about it. Later that day, he had another meeting with that leader in the church, just the way things work. And so he's talking to the leader. And he said as he was talking to the leader started crabbing about that staff member that's on his staff. And then he said, well, he didn't think much about it again. You know, he's like, oh, okay, I'm sorry. We'll try and fix that, blah, 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 blah. And he said, but by the end of the week, he realized that there were factions in the church where some people were going to the staff member, some people were going to the leader, and there was actually this little mini war thing going on. And he said, I really didn't want to deal with it because that's just church life. Come on, how many of you know that? People are just crabby in the church. They crank and they complain. And he said, I just didn't want to deal with it. And he said, God stopped me and said, you must deal with it. Lying, deceit, gossip, those aren't big sins. He hadn't stepped out on his wife. There's no infidelity with any of the leaders on the staff. None of the big sins. And he just wanted to look the other way. And God said, no. And so he did this thing. And I'm like, that's gutsy. He called the staff member, he called the board member, the leader, and he said, I want all the leaders in a room, or all the liars in a room. All the liars. Because he said, both of you can't be telling the truth. And he said, bring all your buddies with you. And he said, it was the most intimidating thing that he ever did. And he said, we sat down in that room, and he said, I made them work through the truth and who was telling the truth. He said, it changed something in the church because our church then became known as a church that won't tolerate that kind of behavior. It changed the sin nature of the church. And guess what happened to the church, by the way? 14,000 people explosion. As I have begun to ask those kind of questions of some of these big pastors, more and more that's what I'm hearing. They don't want to talk about that kind of stuff because let me tell you, it's not fun to go through those type of things in a church. Amen, board members? But it's necessary. Ken Murphy, a couple weeks ago, I was talking to him. He's the pastor of our largest church in our district down in Columbus. They have about 4,000 people, big church. They got stuck at 2,000, and he said, we were letting some things go in our church where we were caring more about, get this, this is a big church. My admiration for Ken went up a couple levels. We were caring more about what happened up here than we cared about people in the pews. The church of 2,000 people. And he said, for me to make that statement and change the way we do church cost me 600 people. Wow. And then guess what happened to their church? Now they're 4,000 and they're building more campuses and they're going crazy. Churches cannot afford to ignore sin inside the church. God understood that. God dealt with it. God knew that. And I want to give you a little side note here, because I don't want you to miss this, and I don't want you to think that God just stepped in and boom, zapped them dead, you know? In the book of Acts, chapter 5, that we just read, God used a man in his process. Who was that man? Who was the spokesman? Peter. And you know what? This early church, it was moving from its infancy into its adolescence. And this church had money issues, people issues. In fact, we're going to see this happen in Acts chapter 5. They even had crabby issues because some people weren't getting what they thought they should deserve, blah, 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 blah. So they had issues going on inside the church. And do you think that church could have used that money? Do you think our church could have used that money? Any of you, by the way, have some land that you want to sell? We got a nice check, but we could use more, okay? You know? And it would have been very tempting for Peter simply to look the other way and say, it's no big deal. I know their heart's not right, but it's God's money now. And Peter wasn't willing to go there. He wasn't willing to take a blessing over dealing with what needed to be dealt with in the church. So it wasn't just God stepping in, it was the leaders of the church. It was Peter also saying, this just isn't right, and we can't go there. Now let me give you two personal principles to sort of wrap this up. Here's two personal principles. We can only be as spiritually healthy as our latest sin. You might want to write that down. We can only be as spiritually healthy as our latest sin. Before we leave this topic, I want us to go here because this is so glaringly true. As Christians, we are not going to be healthy if there is sin in our lives. That's the principle that needs to come into our personal lives. You will not be healthy if you are engaging in something you know is out of step with God. In the church, we call that sin. If you are doing something that you know is not making God happy, if you're living away or practicing a principle or doing something that you know God's not pleased with, it goes against His word, you're going to eventually slow down and stop growing spiritually. It's going to happen. I'm going to get a little bold here, but don't kick me out. If that's you, stop blaming the church. If that's you, stop blaming the church. If you have sin in your life, don't come to me and say, well, the worship just isn't there, or you're not preaching good enough, or the church just isn't doing it for me. Deal with the sin in your life. Once you do that, then come talk. We can only be as healthy as our latest sin. If I, as a pastor, do not point out that truth, we as a church are in danger of never being healthy. Because guess what? Is this the church, the walls and the building? Is that the church? No. We are the church. And if we, the church, are going to be healthy, then we have to be careful about guarding sin in our lives personally. And as we begin to grow spiritually, as we begin to get rid of sin in our lives, then we as a church even become more healthy. And here's another thing that I'll put in the second principle here. So we can only be as spiritually healthy as our latest sin. And in Acts, if you're not healthy, you got dead. Okay, just a thought, okay? So here's the other side of it. Guard your motives. Motives are more important than actions. In fact, this was a principle that Jesus camped on a lot. Long before a person ever commits adultery, they've already begun lusting over somebody in their heart. Long before a person kills somebody, they've already went to a point of anger in their heart. Long before anybody ever thinks of stealing, they've already stopped trusting God to provide everything that they need. And so Jesus is very clear about this principle. Your actions stem out of your motives. And so guard your motives. Guard your motives. Ananias' heart and his motives were wrong. He was not motivated out of passion for the church, but he was motivated by his own greed, his own desire for applause, and so motivated by it that he was willing to lie in order to get a little bit of applause. Just a point here, by the way, the sin was not that Ananias and Sapphira held back money. There was nothing wrong. Do you realize when you go back to Acts chapter 4, Barnabas didn't sell everything? Catch that. Go back and read it. He sold a field, meaning he probably had many more fields, and he sold one and gave it to the apostles. And so Ananias and Sapphira's sin wasn't that they held back some. It wasn't that we all are going to give God this much. We made a decision. We're going to give God this much, and we're going to keep this much. That wasn't the sin. The sin was, we're going to say we gave it all so people go, wow, look at them. That was the sin. Their sin was their motive for why they did what they did. We have to be careful of that. This is a huge trap that people can fall into that can sidetrack them spiritually. I want everybody to believe that I'm better than I really am. I've called it the miracle of the doors. That we can get in a knockdown, drag-out fight with our spouse on the way to church, but as soon as you hit the church doors, oh yeah, we've had a great weekend. Kids have been wonderful. And what are we doing? We're putting on pretense. Because we don't want anybody to know that we are messed up. We do have our bad hair days. We do have times when things don't work like they should. We might even not be as spiritual as we would like everybody to think we are. And this can be such a trap, such a danger for the church that our motives get off-centered. And so watch your motives. Watch your motives. Here's how we're going to wrap up this morning. Michelle, if you'd come on up. I want to give us just a moment to pray and to think, because sometimes our lives get so packed and so full, we just don't stop to think. And I would like to encourage you to start a practice, a weekly practice to put into your life. And it's simply the practice of reflection or self-examination. And I think it would be wise for all of us. It does not matter whether you've been in the church for 40 years or whether you just showed up. I think all of us every week need to stop and simply take a look inward. And here's two great questions for self-examination. Father, number one, Father, is there no sin in my life? Am I doing something that you do not approve of? Lifestyle, habit, action, word, whatever it is there no sin in my life? And write it down. Name it. And number two, and what am I going to do about it? What am I going to do about it? Ignore it? Fix it? Get help with it? Maybe get accountability for it? Every week we should be asking ourselves or taking a moment to do that little bit of self-examination. Is there no sin in my life? And what am I going to do about it? And here's the thing, you will never be as healthy or never be healthy beyond your latest no sin. Let's take just a minute this morning. I want to give you those 2 minutes as a gift this morning. It's a gift for you. It's not for the kids' life people. A gift for you to stop and just ask those two questions. Is there sin in my life? Father, show it to me, point it out. What am I going to do about it? Not saying you have to, but if you'd like to come up and just say, God, I need to confess this up here. I need to make it a little more public. I need to get this right. The altars, they're always available for you to come and pray. Take 2 minutes just for self-examination, reflection. Dear Heavenly Father, we understand, we know you take sin very seriously. It's because you are holy, you are righteous, you are perfect, and you want that of your people. But I also realize, God, that you want that for us because when we sin, when we bring things into our lives that you don't approve of, it's because it hurts us. It's unhealthy for us. Unhealthy spiritually, unhealthy even sometimes physically, relationally. And so, God, I pray you'll put your finger on our hearts. And I hope, God, that we can be open enough to say, please do. We would rather you point it out than for it to destroy us. And so, Father, by the power of your Holy Spirit, speak into us. Reveal those things that you're wanting us to fix, to correct, to change, to be transformed in. And Father, then give us the insight to know, what do we do about it? Just confess it? Do we need to get help for it? God, give us direction to be able to deal with this sin, to be able to deal with a wrong motive, maybe a bad attitude. Maybe we've gotten caught up in the rumor mill and gossip, whatever. Father, help us to know how to fix it, how to make it right. Show us, God, that old Catholic word, penance. Show us how to make it right so that hopefully we won't go down that road again. So God, hear our prayer this morning. See our hearts. Help us to be pure. And Father, then I finish out the sermon this morning, this teaching this morning. I ask for boldness. Prayer was foundational to this new church over and over and over again. They were a praying people. And Father, as we deal with this topic this morning, our leaders in our church need boldness. I need boldness. Father, I'll be the first to confess, I'd rather look the other way and not deal with a tough thing, with a difficult issue, with something that's going to be maybe hurtful or somebody may take offense. And God, I'd love to look the other way. But God, I know we can't afford to. So I pray for boldness for each of the leaders who have been asked to serve our church, to lead and guide us into the future, that you will give them boldness, that you'll give them each conviction of heart. And yet, Father, overlay all of that with your love and your passion and compassion for people. So, Father, help us. Help us to lead your church well. Help us to be a healthy church, a vital church that's doing great things for your kingdom. And Father, finally, I say thank you for your word. Thank you for Luke writing the principles of his gospel message and then the actions that took place in the book of Acts. Thank you that we can learn, that we can be guided, and hopefully, Father, learn from the past so we can be or correct or have a better future. And these things in your name we pray. Be with us, God. Lead and guide. Amen.